This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at amazing true stories of Australian woman pilots. In the news, predicting the air travel recovery, airlines respond to shifts in demand, hitching a ride across the Atlantic on a jet stream, finding roles for U.S. Air Force tankers that still aren't ready for full operations, preventing cabin crew from disappearing at the flight destination, and Alaska Airlines sweepstakes for lovers. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 640 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me this episode is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's also a national CFI of the year, and of course, he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Well, I'm also an expert at being separated. My wife got exposed to COVID a week ago, so we are living in different parts of the house right now.
Oh,
so,
my.
We both got tested today, so I think we're going to be fine, but it's just annoying to be segregated and wearing a mask in the house. But, you know, that's just part of all the joy of this experience.
So whose part of the house has the kitchen? Your half or her half?
Her half.
Oh, well, you know, the kitchen's one thing, but if you got a side of with the bathroom, that's a real issue.
Fortunately, more than one bathroom in the house. But yeah, I've been eating all my meals back here in the studio office. So, you know, I just hang out here next to my computer most of the day.
Sounds like fun.
Oh, well.
All right. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hey, everyone. I'm not living such an exciting life. I'm living at home, and just we've been dealing with snow, which has kind of been peculiar this year because last year we didn't have any, but I think I'd rather have the snow over COVID, so well, good for that.
Yes, I'm getting tired of shoveling the stuff, but let's introduce our guest, who is, well, she's in a different cycle of the planet. We have with us Kathy Mekstad, who's a writer, a photographer, and an editor of Air Sport magazine. And that comes from Sport Aircraft Association Australia, which is a GA organization. Now, Kathy's written for a number of publications, but recently she's written a book titled Australian Women Pilots, subtitled Amazing True Stories of Women in the Air. Kathy, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Mac. Thanks for having me.
Now, really astute and longtime listeners may actually remember Kathy's name, or it might sound a little bit familiar. That's because, well, she's Australian, and she has been known to hang out with a few of our Australian friends from Plane Crazy Down Under, Grant and Steve. So it's really exciting to have Kathy. This is a very interesting, very amazing book. And we're going to start off talking with Kathy and then come back to the news after that. So let's get right into it. Now, Kathy, in the book, you tell us the story of, I believe, 10 women that all have really fascinating, remarkable stories. And we'll talk in a little bit about how this came together and how you found these stories. But to give our listeners an idea of the kinds of stories that we can find in this book, maybe let's talk a little bit about the first Australian woman to fly around the world in a single-engine airplane solo. Maybe give us sort of a brief version of Gabby's story.
Thank you. Gabby Kennard in 1989 was a single mother of two children, and she had this burning desire to fly around the world for probably some personal reasons, various reasons. Who knows what causes pushes somebody to do these things. And she drew back on her mortgage, bought a single-engine Saratoga, had it kitted out with long-range fuel tanks and everything that she could afford and think that she needed, borrowed some survival gear and headed off in August 1989. She intended to be gone for 33 days and she came back 99 days later. So it was quite a remarkable feat, and it was a long trip, yeah.
Yeah, and she more or less followed Amelia Earhart's route. But as to her motivation, it seems like she was doing it for the love of flying and not for some promotional purpose or to seek notoriety particularly. It seemed like it was kind of a humble flight.
She had absolutely no desire for the publicity other than the fact that the publicity provided sponsorship. So that was the only reason she got tangled up with that side of it. But it became a big thing, and because, you know, the country was pretty gripped by this housewife who's at 40 has left the kids with some friends, some reliable friends, and taken off around the world. And she was intrigued by Amelia Earhart, actually, and she loved Amelia Earhart's story. She'd been flying across the Pacific with a guy named Jim Hazelton, who's a well-known Australian aviator. And when they got to Majuro, or the Marshall Islands, he said, "This is about where we think Amelia Earhart went missing." And it really got Gabby thinking again about it, and she dived into any books she could find on Earhart and other female aviators when she got back. And that really spurred her on. So, you know, when someone gets a good idea. But for Gabby to do that trip, I think it was about finding self-confidence, and she just felt she really had to do something for herself to take control of her life, and you know how it can be being a wife and a mother.
Well, she had some real challenges along the way besides being separated from her family. And I saw how she, you know, at various stops along the way would get in touch with her family and kind of, you know, reconnect as she could. But she did have some challenges. One of them was, navigation. Navigation then was not like what we have now, not as reliable. So she had to rely on her own abilities.
She did, yes. She had an Amiga satellite navigation system, like an early form of GPS, but it kept breaking down. And so it was really only useful on, I think it was the second half of the Pacific flight between Hawaii and California and somewhere over Asia just for a short time. It hardly worked at all. So she was just down to the maps and the NDB when she arrived. But she did some, you know, there's some long water crossings on that journey across the Pacific in three hops and across the Atlantic and coming back through, you know, the Far East and the Middle East, and there's a lot of water there.
There is a lot. And I guess along the way, some of her equipment had gotten stolen.
She did. The first stop was Rabaul in New Guinea, and she was about to depart the next morning, and she found that someone had robbed her of her – she had a very high-tech life jacket with whistle and flashlight, all the stuff that you – could want and possibly fit into a life jacket. And so that was gone. And so she had to go and borrow, you know, just, she said she was inclined to call the trip off then, but she went into, I think it was the airline office and they, or it was the bank or somewhere. She had said the safe had been blown open so many times because they'd been robbed so many times that, you know, she thought, oh, that's just the way it is here. So she had to toughen up and keep going. Yeah. She decided, all right, I'll keep going.
When she crossed the Atlantic, it was the South Atlantic. So she was crossing from South America to Africa, I guess.
Natal? Was it? Yes. Yeah.
I think so. Yes, yes. And she encountered a lot of storms crossing the South Atlantic.
Yes. So one of the things, a very fortunate meeting in the US was she found a fellow called Boston Bob. And Boston Bob would predict weather, read the weather. And so she kept in contact with him, and he said to her, as she was going down from Florida down to Brazil, he said to her, "You better get your skates on because there's a hurricane down there and you're going to have to get cracking, you know, to avoid it." But with that weather system, I think came some horrendous storms. But when she departed into the night from Brazil heading to Africa, it was all very calm, and she was up there all alone in the middle of the night in this little engine, single engine aeroplane, nobody to talk to. And then she had spoken to a couple of radio hams in the UK, just by chance picked up her frequency, and they had a chat. And when she hung up from them, she was all alone again. And then she saw a flash in the darkness in the night ahead, and she thought, oh no, that's the storms that I've been warned about. And I think I wrote in the book, she flew a violent marathon for survival, because the lightning took out the electrics, or sent the electrics crazy, and the undercarriage would retract and extend and retract, and the Amiga satellite system completely gave up. And she said it was just hell. It went on for a few hours, and she was being thrown up and down, you know, hundreds of feet. And it's easy to write, but I think it would have been hell to live.
Yeah. And I guess even though she was the, you know, the first Australian woman to do this, as I recall from the book, she didn't even realize that at first.
No, she didn't care about any of that. She wasn't worried about being known for it. She just wanted to do it. And it was only, I don't know, somewhere along the way, somebody figured out that she was the first to do it, and it was superfluous to the task. In fact, when she got home, the publicity was so overwhelming that they moved to the States to just sort of live a quieter life for a while.
And then she moved back to Australia, I think, right?
Yep. I think they're in the States for about 10 years, and then she came back to Sydney.
Now, another woman that you write about, Lynn Gray, she started as a ferry pilot. And I guess she started flying, I don't know if you call it middle age, 37, age 37, when someone gifted her some flying lessons. And that's what started her interest in flying.
Yes, it was her brother gave her a flying, just a joy flight, I think, for her birthday. And I guess 37 or 38, it's a hard birthday to buy for, isn't it? So he sent her off on a flying lesson, and she loved it. And the instructor said, will I ever see you again? And she said, yeah, tomorrow. So she came back, and she became a flying instructor. And she gave up her day job, which was teaching, and went full-time flying. And she worked for a guy named Ray Clamback, and his wife, Aminta Hennessy, had a business at Bankstown in Sydney. And they imported aircraft from the US. And so Lynn started doing those ferry flights.
Now, there are a couple of ditchings in the Pacific associated with her story. The first one was not her. It was a time when a couple of them were flying separate airplanes across the Pacific, and one ditched. And that really caused her some stress in a sort of a, you know, difficult situation.
Yes, if you can imagine being with your work colleague flying in tandem. They were flying 182s, I think, or 185, 182s. They were flying in tandem, and she said she could. She had him, his name was Ray, she had him in her visual the whole time. So he was in her windscreen. She could just look up and to the right and see him. And then she said, Ray, you've slowed down. What's happening? And then she saw a puff of grey smoke, and she said, what's happened? And he said, that's it, the engine has just seized. I'm going in. And so there they were, halfway between Hawaii and Kiribati, and he went down into the ocean, and she followed him down, and she recorded the GPS coordinates, and the aeroplane hit the water, well, didn't spear straight down, he did, you know, a water landing. He ditched, but a wave flipped it over because of the high wings, they flip easier. And she could see that it had oil all over the belly. And then very quickly, she thought she saw a life raft and a life jacket come out each side of the front, but the airplane went straight down, and she, can you imagine, you know? And so she flew around for 4 hours. They called out the US Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard eventually got there, and together they searched. And then the Coast Guard said to Lynn, you're going to have to go, because we don't want to be looking for two aeroplanes. And so she flew on to Kiribati, and they eventually got the news later that night that he'd been picked up. It was amazing.
Right. And she circled the area for, like you said, for 4 hours trying to spot him unsuccessfully, as it turned out. You know, like you say, you know, your coworker is down there somewhere and you don't know what his situation is, if he's alive or if he's drowned or what. And then when the Coast Guard eventually comes, I think it was a C-130 Hercules that came first, as I recall. And yeah, imagine being told, you know, you better get going, you know, let us handle it, and leaving your friend there is that's a tough thing.
Well, she'd been there for 4 hours and she still had 3 hours to fly on to Kiribati. So that would have been a very long day. And she had to face his wife when she got to Kiribati. That would have been difficult as well. Very difficult, I think.
So that's only the first part of the story. The second part involves her own situation.
Yes. So it was the same two pilots. It was Lynn. She had a co-pilot with her. She was in a twin-engine Seminole. And Ray was in a similar aircraft with his co-pilot. They were both young guys in their 20s, just getting experience. And as they were flying, they left Santa Barbara. They were flying to Hilo and they noticed a burn mark on the wing. And just as instinct, a precaution, like as you would, Lynn reached back to check the ferry bladder, to check that it was still taut, and it wasn't. And it was, you know, can imagine the horror. In the end, they figured out back in Sydney that the plumbing was misplumbed and there was fuel streaming out the left wing. And so they didn't have enough fuel to go back to California and they didn't have enough to get to Hawaii. So they had the extremely unenviable task of ditching the aircraft in the Pacific Ocean.
But they knew they had some hours of flight, given the fuel that they had. And they really used the time to prepare for the ditching. And I thought it was fascinating to read how, you know, they did things like they propped something in the door so that when the plane did go down and if the fuselage bent, that it wouldn't, you know, the door wouldn't be jammed. Some other things. Oh, I think they cut open some of the cushions take the padding out to put that in, you know, in front of them, between them and the instrument panel, so that on the impact they would have that additional padding, and a number of other things, preparing and taking their headsets off so that they wouldn't get those, you know, get tangled up in those. Ditching has got to be in the ocean in the Pacific has got to be a pretty major event. Anyway, but to have several hours to not only plan for it, but also, you know, worry about all the things you might worry about. Max, can you imagine just like all the things that would be going through your head if you knew you were going to have to ditch and you had some hours to prepare for it?
You're right. I think that the worry, if you had that much time, might be a little difficult. You know, there was a Cirrus that was in that situation just a few years ago that was going to Hawaii from the United States. And again, it was a case where I believe that there was something misplumbed with the ferry tanks, and they knew a few hours before that they were going to run out of fuel and not make it. And they were in contact with the Coast Guard, which directed them to put it down near a cruise ship. And so they got a cruise ship ride home.
Yeah. Max, you've ferried aircraft, but over land only, right? So you haven't been involved in things like fuel bladders and things like that, have you?
Oh, I've been over some large bodies of water. Mississippi River is one I can think of. No, you're right. All of my moving of aircraft from coast to coast is over the U.S., so water is not really a consideration.
Yeah. So, Kathy, one of the things that is appealing to me about the book is that you have an aviation background. Your family includes some aviators. Your husband is an airline pilot, and the stories are told, I think, from the perspective of someone who has the knowledge, the perspective of a pilot. So there's lots of detail in the stories that I think would appeal to aviators in general. because you come with that background, as opposed to, you know, someone else. Sometimes you hear or you read a book that contains stories of individuals, but it's written by a person who is not an expert in that field. I mean, they may be good at digging out the story and relating the story, but not necessarily with the, you know, with the perspective of someone who would be intimately involved in that like you are. So I think that makes the stories really, really compelling to people who are aviation enthusiasts.
Thanks, Max. When it was suggested to me, I wondered if I'd be up to the task because aviation has a lot of experts and it's always difficult to write for an informed audience. But I wanted this to be to go a lot further than just the aviation audience. I wanted it to cross sort of straddle two audiences. And so I needed to put in just enough aviation geekery to satisfy the geeks and to keep it simple enough or mainstream enough for the average reader. And the feedback I've had has sat pretty comfortably that, you know, tells me that I've managed to do that. So I didn't want to get bogged down in technicalities, and I did tend to do that occasionally, and so I would walk around the house and read it to myself out loud and think, I'm sick of reading those speeds now, those numbers, so I'll just cut that whole bit out and tell it in a simple way.
And so was there one of these stories that really resonated with you or that sparked this? Was there a starting point for the collection of stories?
Yes, there was. When it was suggested to me that I have a think about doing a book like this, I just wasn't quite sure where to start. And, you know, and then there's that fantastic moment where someone gives you the gift of their story. And I was at a conference, the Australian Women Pilots Association conference, and I heard 88-year-old Patricia Toole speak about her time flying in New Guinea in 1952 and 53. And she was such a good storyteller. She was 88 at the time, and she stood up in front of a couple of hundred people, and the room was just spellbound, thinking, bah, that's not what we expected to hear from this old lady, you know. And, you know, you've read the story about Pat, and there's a part where she's had to do a forced landing onto a river, and she's out there for 40 hours before Jock McGregor, who was the patrol officer, walked in through the jungle and rescued her. And she had been dropped some inedible food, some water, a Luger pistol, and a bottle of rum. That's what they deemed in 1953 that a good gal needs to survive in the jungle. So that's what she had. And so when Jock McGregor turned up 2 days after she, you know, she'd been out there for 2 days, they introduced themselves, and she said, "Jock, would you like a rum?" And he said, "Good God, you know, how good's that?" So when I heard that line, "Jock, would you like a rum?" It was like a light came, a beam shone down from the heavens and said, "Kathy, you have to tell this story." And she passed away 2 weeks later, sadly, without any warning. And so I was kind of left with the story, and her children very kindly gave me her notes. And then I started digging around, and she had written her version of a book previously, and so I had it in her words, and I'd heard her tell the stories, and so I then started finding people who were around at the time in New Guinea, people who knew the airline, people who still live in New Guinea who could get me their maps, the WAC charts, and find out names of rivers and mountains and villages, and yeah, that took a lot of education to put that story together, but I loved it.
So, Kathy, you're down in Australia, but here in the United States, you know, basically we would say alcohol and firearms—that's the making of a good party.
It was a party for one.
Yeah, when you're crashed.
It was a party for two when Jock arrived. Yeah,
Patricia sounds like, you know, the sort of person that you would just love to meet. Here she was, a young woman, as you mentioned, you know, blonde and all, and she's amongst a bunch of tough guys in New Guinea doing what's it's like bush flying. They're flying
Norsemen and Austers and, you know, tail draggers in these mountainous areas, very difficult places to land, carrying freight, carrying people without radios, which was kind of interesting because it is, as you explained, because for one thing, you know, you wouldn't have terrific radio reception in that kind of terrain anyway. And, you know, in those days they were, you know, big and heavy, and you could take the radios out of the plane, save some weight, and that just lets you bring some more cargo in.
You could put a pig in.
You could put a pig, yes. And so, you know, there she is out there with an aircraft failure. And that was the story where she was kind of enveloped in the clouds, right? And she wasn't sure, and she couldn't see anything, right? Zero visibility. But then a little hole opened up and she saw the riverbed that was her one and only chance to get the airplane down.
Yeah, she landed. She did a precautionary search before she put down on the riverbed, and she did a ground loop because as she was rolling out on the shingles, she was coming towards some trees, and so she had to do a ground loop, and she connected with a rock, which wiped out the one undercarriage leg. But the aircraft was remarkably intact, and her boss was extremely grateful, and he wrote a book, and he said in his book that had she not hit the rock, it probably could have been flown out again.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, when they checked the fuel, she had 1 gallon of fuel left in the tanks.
Wow. And I understand they did get the plane out. They disassembled the plane and carried the parts out.
Yeah, they carried the plane out and took it to Drekkekir, and then they put it back together, and then somebody just flew it home, and she was back in it a couple of weeks later, flying around the highlands. New Guinea's on the equator, of course, too, so that's why the cloud, when you're on the equator in that jungle, you know, the cloud is so quick to form, and she just got caught out in it.
So I think this is it's a great book because, well, for a variety of different reasons. I think the stories are individually compelling, well told. Thank you, Kathy. And I don't know how to put this because I was thinking about this before, and I don't know how to say this without it sounding kind of, I don't know, not representing what I'm thinking. But they're all women pilots, but the stories don't hit you like the point of this is that they are women pilots. To me, anyway, my reaction was, these are pilots. These are amazing pilots who did some amazing things. Sometimes they got lucky. Sometimes they used the, you know, the skills and, you know, their own wits to survive situations or to, you know, advance in their field. So I don't know. I just found it just a really appealing kind of a book, appealing reading for that reason as well. I don't know if you sort of intended that or if I'm being really clear with what I'm trying to say.
I definitely did intend it to be like that. It's not meant to be a book about, oh, look, she's a woman. How clever that she can fly a plane because the airplane doesn't care if you're a man, woman or beast, you know, as long as you can fly the plane. But because I was committed to that title, I still had to find good stories. Well, I'm a pilot and I know lots of women pilots, but not every one of them, including me, would have enough to fill 7,000 words. And so I really just wanted really good, readable, exciting stories. And I didn't want them all to be heroic or, you know, the first woman to fly whatever just because she's a woman. You know what I mean? So it had to be just a good story. And being woman was just one of the tick boxes, the boxes you had to tick. So it was, I also chose to take one from each decade. That was kind of a timeline thing I followed roughly, and that worked pretty well too. So as you could see, a shift in attitudes because Nancy Bird, who was the first female commercial pilot in Australia in the 30s, had a very different time of it to the last person in the book who is still flying now. In fact, the last two are still flying now. And, you know, in the Air Force there's plenty of women pilots, flying doctors, yeah. So it's a different world, and I wanted to show that as well. So it's not a history book as such, but it does cover some good history. You know, World War II with an Australian woman in England delivering Spitfires for the Air Transport Auxiliary, which is their version of your, I think, WASPs, is it?
Yes.
She was the only, born and bred and returned to Australia. Gabby's story was just so fascinating because she, not because she was a woman, I guess, but being female does present you with certain challenges, like you're usually the main caregiver. There were just issues that came up throughout the stories that I didn't hone in on, but that just come up by virtue of being who you are, you know. Somebody else pointed that out to me. They said, oh, there were some issues with kids, and some people had issues with once they got married, it got more difficult. And I didn't sort of set out to prove those points, but they're just part of the story. Georgia, the girl on the cover, she was an ag pilot, flies the air tractors, the good old American air tractors, and she was in the 802, but she ended up giving it up after 16 years because she had children, and she said, I felt like I was the one that had to be caring for the kids, and, you know, she'll go back to it once they're up and off her hands.
So do you think there's any more books in your future?
I don't know. I think writing the first one's really the hardest because you don't know what people think of it or am I any good at this? And so because this one's got such a strong response, I feel more confident about doing another one. I think perhaps I'd like to look at women from different areas of aviation. So maybe a helicopter pilot, a balloon pilot, a astronaut, have we got one? I don't know. So something like that, maybe I might do a screenplay or anything could happen. Got any ideas? Feedback is always welcome.
Yeah.
I think some of the book, I think some of the stories in that book lend themselves beautifully to screenplays. So I'd like to have a go at something like that.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think, some plot lines in some of these that would lend themselves to to a big film production. That might be kind of fun.
We might be out there ditching in the Pacific.
Yeah. So, Kathy, where do we find the book?
So you can just order it in the US through any bookstore, and they'll get it in for you, or you can. If you want a signed copy, that's very expensive because postage from Australia is something ridiculous, like $20 or $30, I think. I have sent one to Canada for somebody. Or you can download it. So it's available to download in the US and Canada, internationally, anywhere, I think.
And how about people that want to learn more about you or your activities, website or social media presence?
Yeah, so it's kathymexted.com.au, Kathy with a K, Mexted with an M-E-X-T-E-D. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and I've got a website.
Very good. And you do a little bit of photography too.
I love photography. I've got a wedding coming up. I've got a magazine that has no cover shot, so I'm going to have to go and rifle through my black book and find somebody to take me up and get a cover shot for Air Sport. That's due out in about 3 weeks. And, family, anything. Mainly my photography is to complement whatever magazine I'm writing for at the time. So I'm freelance, so farming, families, weddings, airplanes, flying. They all start with F, don't they?
Very good. All right. Well, Kathy, we really appreciate you being able to come on the show and talk with us. We even, I think we were successful with the internet, given we had some challenges getting that going with you, but really glad you came on the show.
Thanks, Max. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me and especially to read the stories. It gives me great joy to know that you've enjoyed them. And I hope your listeners do too.
I think they will. I really think they will. Our first news story is air travel recovery likely pushed back to 2022. This is a Bloomberg story in the Press Herald. And we might have been overly optimistic last year when we thought that a COVID vaccine would quickly turn everything around for the travel industry. Well, it's not working out quite that way. We have a sort of a slow pace of vaccinations. It's not clear that being vaccinated prevents you from transmitting the virus to others. We're seeing mutations come up. Borders are still closed in some countries. And there's no overall consensus about the so-called vaccine passports. So the International Air Transport Association, IATA, said recently that in a worst-case scenario, passenger traffic may only improve by 13% this year, even though its official forecast is for a 50% rebound that was issued in December. I don't know. Did you guys feel the same way that I did, that, you know, with the coming of a vaccine, that things would quickly return to, quote, normal?
You know, I think 13% is pessimistic. I think the air travel will jump more than that this year. I mean, the problem is that, you know, we're working at such a low baseline, you know, that any increase is going to be good and significant.
Well, that's true. When you see business go down 85 or 90 or even 95%, it doesn't take much traffic to give you a good percentage increase.
I don't know. It seems, I think the problem is I'm not sure if it was expected or not, but I think these mutations are going to, I don't want to say set us back, but it just complicates things more than we were expecting. You know, in fact, today in the news, I heard that the AstraZeneca in South Africa isn't even affecting their South African variant of the disease, the infection. So I don't know. I mean, it's complicated, and, you know, and we're even hearing discussions that they're going to have negative tests for domestic travel, you know, and that's kind of frightening.
It is changing the landscape. And Max, we see in Bloomberg that there's some shifting of the type of air travel that we're seeing.
Yes, and so it looks like at least leisure travel is rebounding a little bit, whereas business travel, I think we can all expect to be slow to come back. I think people are just itching to go on their vacations, and I think that demand is going to pick up. And Bloomberg says that there's been some rearrangement of flights, and that, for example, there are now fewer flights across the Atlantic to London, and that would be because of the drop in business travel. And yet there is extreme demand at places like Los Cabos, Mexico, which would be the very tip of Baja Sur, Mexico. And I'm not surprised. I've been there, and it's a wonderful place. It's quick and easy to get to. It's just a great tourist destination. So in the past, I guess they've had, you know, relatively few flights there, but they're piling on a lot of flights. I would expect that, you know, there are probably going to be more flights to Florida. So, yeah, I think there are bright spots in this, which is great.
Yeah, they also mentioned that for leisure travelers, convenience is a big factor in this, particularly in the number of stops you have to make. And so at least some airlines are responding to that by kind of shifting a little bit from the hubs to more direct flights, direct routes for the benefit of for the convenience of the leisure travelers. Certainly if you're traveling with a family and all and kids and having to change planes or flying to a hub and then changing gates and all is much less convenient than a direct flight. So the airlines are making those kinds of accommodations. Of course, we've said many times how it's really the business travelers that pay the high ticket prices and generate most of the profits for the airlines. So if we're seeing this shift towards more of a leisure traveling component, I don't know how that affects the business models and the pricing models. I mean, in part, it depends on to what degree business travel resumes. Resumes is a good word because of Zoom, because that may cause business travel to not resume as much.
Well, fortunately, Zoom is not going to replace leisure travel. I don't see anybody going, wow, it looks beautiful in Cabo San Lucas right now. It's like, no, no, no. You got to be there. You got to feel that sun beating on your skin. You got to feel the sand between your toes. And I'm sure there are probably a couple people listening right now going, oh, yeah, I think I'd like to book something right now.
Yeah.
I think basically we're putting the cart before the horse. I think we got to get through this first 6 months. I think the second half of the year will be where we're going to, if it's going to take off, excuse the pun, it'll take off after the second half of the year. I think once we get into the summer tourist travels here in the States, you know, late May in the summer, we'll know if there's going to be a recovery or not, where if something comes up. I'm speaking from planning for the museum. I mean, most of all of our events and stuff like that is planned for starting in like August for the second half of the year. So, I mean, we're not expecting anything the first half of the year, unfortunately.
Well, and I think Donald Rumsfeld had it correct. I mean, we certainly, regarding COVID, we have some known unknowns, but we also have some unknown unknowns as well.
Yes. Yeah. And David, I'm seeing what you're saying, too. If you look at, for example, our aviation calendar, avgeekfests.com, in the first half of the year, there are a lot of virtual events. Well, not a lot of events, but most of the events in the first half of this year, 2021, are virtual events, and we're seeing more and more actual physical events in the second part of the year. So, people are not planning, for the most part, on physical events in the near term, but it appears people event organizers are optimistic enough to start to plan in-person events for the second part of the year, or at least kind of like from August on. So maybe it's more like the end of the year, but we are seeing that. Well, we've been talking about flying over the ocean in a couple of different contexts this episode. In the Point Sky, we see fly like the wind. Pilots are about to cross the Atlantic in a whole new way. Max, what are we seeing here?
Well, if you look at how pilots cross the oceans, and let's just talk about the Atlantic for now, there are traditionally six or seven tracks that aircraft follow to get from North America to Europe and vice versa. And these tracks all vary from day to day and even from, I think, day to night. And essentially, the process is that the airlines will put in their preferred routes. They submit that to NATS, which runs the air traffic out of the UK. And, of course, the UK manages the eastern half of the Atlantic. It also goes to NAV Canada, which manages the western part of the Atlantic. And based on all these inputs and preferred routings, the tracks are then generated. The problem in the past has been that there are a lot of aircraft using these tracks, and so they've been widely separated. They've been 60 miles apart, which puts some aircraft in less favorable winds than other aircraft. Well, given that we've got far less traffic right now going across the Atlantic, it's given everybody an opportunity to experiment with some new routing. And so basically they've started with 30 nautical mile separation between the tracks, because most aircraft now have better position information as well. And so they don't need quite the separation. And they're looking, I think, at a little bit more direct routing as well, and not necessarily just following the tracks. But the key out of all of this is it looks like it's going to be significant savings in fuel and also in the carbon emissions. And they're talking in 2 to 3% range. But as we've talked before on this show, a 2 to 3% savings, that is huge. Anytime you can get that kind of a gain on something like fuel, that can have a huge impact on the bottom line for an airline.
These tracks actually has a name, this system. It's the Organized Track Structure, or OTS. And at least originally, we have all this separation because there are parts of the North Atlantic route that are not covered by radar. So you've got aircraft flying without the benefit of that. And so to keep them separated, they devised this system, this OTS system, where, as you mentioned, Max, there are, you know, a number of different tracks. And there's a whole process for each day, the airlines working with those with NATS and NAV Canada to establish the routes. But in addition, you have the jet stream. And the jet stream, which flows from Canada towards Europe, flows to the east, it can have some pretty significant wind velocities. And part of this idea is that if you can ride those jet streams, that you can save a lot of fuel and, you know, burn a lot less and carbon emissions and all of that. So, yeah, like you say, this is a great time now that we have GPS and other, you know, we have positioning navigation systems that are much more accurate. So this is a good opportunity to say, well, let's try something that doesn't follow this OTS process, at least in terms of, you know, establishing routes, and let's ride the wind. It makes a lot of sense.
And we have a lot of ForeFlight users, I'm sure, and probably Garmin Pilot as well, any of the electronic flight bag apps. You can actually view the OTS tracks in ForeFlight for sure. I'm not sure if Garmin Pilot has it as well. Sorry, I can't tell you exactly, you know, what to click on to do that. But if you go into the manual, you can find out how to display them. So I see them all the time, both for the Atlantic and the Pacific. They have their own individual names, and they do move from day to day.
So this is great. I hope this yields some significant savings. This comes from Reading University researchers. So hopefully we'll be hearing more about, you know, how these tests proved out in the not too distant future. All right, we have an item from Defense One. Air Force hunts for ways to use not quite ready tankers. Well, the Boeing KC-46, of course, is behind schedule. Tankers are still being tested. We have several issues, one of them being the refueling system, which you may recall is new in this aircraft, new in the KC-46, where instead of the old style, you know, boom operator or the operator looking out a window and visually, you know, maneuvering the boom or whatever needs to be maneuvered, it's a guy looking at a computer screen. And there have been some issues with that. That's being addressed. They're planning on installing higher resolution cameras, different computer system, but that's not expected until 2023. So the Air Force, I guess, is trying to think about what can we do with these airplanes that have already been delivered? A number of them have been delivered. A number of them are still to be delivered. I guess the Air Mobility Command is exploring limited operational capability for the KC-46. That's their quote. I don't know what that means exactly, but, you know, we bought these airplanes. It'd be nice to use them.
Well, they are cargo airplanes, so you can use them to haul cargo. That's part of their mission. There's a reason why it is a C as well as a K. And you can use them for troop transport. You can use them for aeromedical evacuation. I mean, KC-135s and KC-10s, I mean, the KC-10 existed because it had the ability to provide cargo support, substantial cargo support, besides refueling. The KC-46 is going to replace those aircraft, and they're going to have to use them until the boom system gets fixed, but they're still cleared to deliver fuel to quite a few aircraft. So, and they're still testing, and you still have to do conversion. The pilots have to learn the new aircraft. So, I mean, it's a really bad headline because the boom system isn't working. But the other thing about it is you don't need the boom system if you're going to fly with the drogue system. on the aircraft. So the aircraft was capable of refueling all the Navy and Marine aircraft, as well as our allies who use the probe and drogue system. You don't need the cameras to operate the flying boom. So you can use them to drag aircraft through the Pacific for the Marine Corps or for the Navy. There's a lot of options out there for them to be implemented and to get techniques to support the aircraft and all of the other facilities built, etc. So unfortunately, a bad circumstance is that the boom doesn't work as well as it should. It's getting binoculars, but look at what binoculars did to the Hubble telescope. It became a phenomenal telescope after it was originally not able to focus on anything. So the tankers are going to be around for several hundred years, so they got time to get them working properly.
Speaking about airplanes being around for a couple hundred years, the B-52, did you see the flyover, David?
I did.
We should explain what three planes were part of the Super Bowl flyover.
Well, the Super Bowl it was Super Bowl 55. So if you take a B-52 and a B-1 and a B-2 and you add them all together,
no,
you get 55. Which is why they did the flyover.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Does anybody know that besides you?
Well, I learned it on the internet, so
I'd never heard that.
But yeah, that's how they came up with it. The B-1, B-2, and a B-52. You get 55.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So that flyover occurred, and a couple of comments on that was. Some people were explaining that it was way too expensive to be flying those three bombers over the football game, to which a lot of other people said, well, no, it's just a basic training flight and with the added benefit of a very huge recruiting tool.
Yeah, exactly.
That Neil deGrasse Tyson made a comment that it looked like the bat plane was leading the formation, which I thought was kind of humorous. But then Global Strike Command retorted back that we can confirm that it was not the bat plane. However, we cannot confirm if Wonder Woman's invisible jet was or was not part of the flyover. So let's hear it for Global Strike Command. So, I mean, I love it. It was a really nice, very nice flyover and, it way to project power, seeing the three aircraft together. My only wish was, kind of wish the B-1 would have pulled up into the vertical like it does at the end of its performance and done its barrel roll. But that wouldn't have been very nice for a flyover. But you guys can dream.
So now that we know the way these three airplanes were chosen, I'm kind of wondering, did they use the P-51 last year?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why would they use, if it was Super Bowl 54, why would they use a P-51?
Well, and also a B-1 and a B-2 adds up to 54. Take B-52, subtract 1, gives you P-51 for last year.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Math is not my strong suit. Yeah, I'm a historian, not a mathematician.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I posted a link in our Slack team of, it was a, I think a local television station that had several videos of the flyover, both the official video or the video from inside the stadium, but also looked like some other videos taken by, I don't know, the public or, somebody outside the stadium of, their approach to the stadium. So if you're in our Slack team, look for that and you can see the flyover from different angles, different perspectives. It's pretty cool. All right. Another item. I wouldn't say it's pretty cool. I'd say this is really kind of strange. And it appears that Pakistan International Airlines has been having, a little problem with some of its cabin crew.
Yeah. It turns out that they've had two cases now on flights to Canada where they had fewer people show up for the return trip, that is crew members, than they had for the inbound trip to Toronto. And so they've had to get a little creative because I would imagine that creates quite a problem. Depending upon the requirements, they might not be able to fly the return flight if they don't have enough crew show up. But the reason the crew is not showing up, at least in these two cases, is they don't want to go back to Pakistan. They've decided they want to live in Canada. And I was thinking it's rather clever. They don't even have to pay to get there. They were paid to get them there. And then they just kind of walk off and that's it. Anyway, since this has happened twice now in 6 months, they've decided, let's see if we can make this a little bit more difficult now. So the new policy with the airline is that when the crew arrives in Toronto, that after they go through customs, their passports are surrendered. So they've also asked the hotels to provide some security and to report if the employees do not show up, in their rooms. So, interesting challenge.
I wonder if this will give some ideas to other airline cabin crew that look at this and say, oh, that's a really clever way to defect. I wonder if we'll start to see a rash.
Well, it certainly beats the old method of, climbing in the wheel well and hoping that you survive the trip, as some people have done in the past, most of them unsuccessfully.
Yeah. But we haven't seen that in a while, which is good.
It is good.
Yeah. Let's see. Another item here. This is Alaska Airlines. And, what they say is Virginia is for lovers, but Alaska Airlines is too. It appears.
I love this story. And I've enjoyed all the stories that we have found during the pandemic where airlines have been creative about, how do you generate business in these times? This is really kind of cute. They said that as Valentine's Day approached, they came up with a new contest for frustrated long-distance lovers. And I can only imagine that, people who are meeting up online but can't meet in person must be frustrated. And so Alaska Airlines decided to offer 100 round-trip tickets to couples whose passions either began with a long-distance screen romance during the pandemic or a blossoming affection that's been thwarted by stay-at-home orders and travel restrictions. So Alaska Airlines invited couples to submit their love stories and photos for a shot at winning tickets, adding that they wanted to hear about true love and romance that has defied the odds and overcome glitchy video chats, accidental muting, and miles of distance. So you just got to love whoever dreamed this up. Now, by the time I had read the story, the contest had already closed, but they had a link where they said that Romeos and Juliets could enter. So great story all the way around.
It is. They called it the Booking for Love sweepstakes, and they just did random drawings. So they didn't evaluate the stories or anything like that. But I wonder. I wonder what they're going to do with the stories. I mean, since it was just a random drawing for 100 couples, what are they going to do with all those stories and all those photos?
Is this a privacy question here now that all that data has been taken by Alaska Airlines? I wonder if maybe they just kind of use it as a brief qualification. So, for example, if I think I were running the contest and we picked some things out randomly, I would read the story before we notified them because you'd like to see that there's at least some effort has been put into the contest entry to at least make it look legitimate.
Right, right. Now, I hope they're not planning on releasing the winners, the names of the winners.
Ooh.
Because that could be a little embarrassing for some couples, perhaps. I don't know.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah. It's like if you accidentally leave something in a hotel room, something of yours.
Sure.
Even if it's got your name and phone number and everything like that, identifying information on it, it still just goes into the lost and found. And I asked a hotel about that once. I said, well, it had my phone number on it. Why didn't you call me? And they go, no. We will never call because you never know what the circumstances are behind, your visit to that hotel.
So I'm wondering, does Alaska Airlines fly to Las Vegas? Because I'm thinking, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Yeah. They probably do because they have a lot of routes up and down the West Coast.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've been talking about events here and there. And as you've heard, AirVenture Oshkosh is at least currently being planned for this year, 2021. And there have been some stories in the press about some of the COVID protocols that they're planning to undertake. And we will probably have some more information about that in an upcoming episode. But we do have a quick little recording from our reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, on this topic. So let's listen to Launchpad.
Hi, Max. On Thursday, EAA released its new guidances for AirVenture 2021 to deal with the pandemic issue. They include the usual stuff you'd expect, strongly encouraging masks but not requiring them, increased social distancing. There will be fewer exhibits in each indoor exhibit building, creating more walkway and separation between the exhibitors. Additional venues on the grounds will be repurposed to accommodate indoor exhibitors that are moved from the main exhibit hangars. One of the key things that came out was that many of the big annual events, like the Monday night concert, EAA's lifetime membership dinner, the international visitors dinner, the 5K run, and all large corporate events and receptions are not to be held. Unfortunately, this means our listeners' favorite event, Potapalooza, will probably not be allowed to be held this year. This is a big blow to your reporter at large, as it is to all of you, as this has been a very successful and highly anticipated event every year. But take heart, dear listeners, as we still have 5 months away and things could improve. This is your reporter at large, frequency change approved, and let's go out there and try and have a good day.
You know, I'm curious about something. I mean, Launchpad's a pretty big guy, as you know. I mean, he's tall. He's a big guy. You always introduce him as our reporter at large. Do you really mean our large reporter?
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
He is a big guy.
He is a big guy.
Yeah.
And a big heart. We love him.
Oh, yeah. He's a big teddy bear. All right. In fact, speaking of Launchpad, this was a late addition to the lineup here, so I haven't really studied this, but it's from AOPA, and FAA creates gateways for new presidential TFR. And what I see here is that AOPA is working with the FAA and other agencies looking at presidential TFRs and how they might impact general aviation operations. Now, you can imagine this being at least partially motivated by the previous administration travel to Florida. And we saw just because of the location of Mar-a-Lago that it impacted some general aviation activities. So I don't know, Max, have you been following this at all? It sounds like the idea is to take a look at how we can sort of mitigate the impacts on GA.
I think presidential TFRs started getting much larger after 9/11. So we've been through several administrations where TFRs have been incredibly inconvenient for GA pilots. For example, whenever a president visits here in the San Francisco Bay Area, my home airport, Palo Alto, is almost always shut down completely. Because they either land, the plane at Moffett Field, which is 4 miles away, or they landed at San Francisco, which is probably less than 12 or 15 miles away as the crow flies. And so this has been an ongoing issue. AOPA has tried to work with TSA over the years to try and make it a little bit less onerous for GA pilots without, I would say, tons of success. The movement on making this less restrictive has been extremely slow over the years. One thing that they have done, and that's what this story is about, is that they have come up with a gateway airport concept. So essentially, there is a new TFR, which presumably is centered on the president's home in Delaware, and it's a 12 nautical mile radius. There are lots of airports that are, you know, within that ring. The TSA is allowing access to some of the airports within this inner core if they first stop at these gateway airports where passengers and cargo and things like that will be inspected, and then they will be allowed to fly on into the to the inner core of the TFR.
Well, that, I mean, it sounds pretty rational, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
Yeah. All right.
It's going to be interesting with the Newcastle Airport being technically now Biden's home base. I mean, this weekend they flew in the C-32 or the 75 in from, you know, I'm still trying to figure out how long the flight was from Andrews up to Newcastle. But Newcastle is in 12 miles of Philadelphia International. So, I mean, you're putting a TFR right in the middle of a heavy airspace. It's going to be interesting the next 4 years. You know, you could always hope that it could go back to taking the train from D.C. to Wilmington like he did in the past.
Yeah, I think from a security standpoint, they've pretty much ruled out the train.
All right, what's up with the geeks? It's kind of sleepy February around here. Max, you've been looking at some interesting things.
Yes, this week on Aviation News Talk, I will have the probable cause out on the Kobe Bryant crash, which occurred a little over a year and a half ago. The NTSB is going to have a board meeting at which they will basically present all of the data that they've collected. They will come up with their draft probable cause. They will most likely adopt it at that meeting, which, by the way, is going to happen between the time that we record this and the time that people hear this. But this will be the big story for this week on Aviation News Talk, and I believe the entire episode will be devoted to this because, you know, I think it's important to all pilots, but especially general aviation pilots. I suspect, you know, I don't know for sure, but my guess is that, you know, the pilot will be found to have been at fault for entering IMC conditions when he was flying VFR. When I talk with my student pilots and they become, you know, private pilots, I always tell them, do not enter a cloud under penalty of death. Those are the words I use, and I do that purposely because I want them to understand that the consequences of inadvertently going into the clouds are really, really, really high. If you look at accidents in general, we often look at the lethality, which is the percentage of accidents that are fatal. And inadvertent flight into IMC has the highest percentage of fatal accidents. It's somewhere on the order of 90%, which means if you accidentally fly into a cloud and you crash, there's about a 90% chance that people on board will not survive that the encounter. You look at that versus landing accidents where, you know, the lethality rate is very, very, very low. And only a small percentage of landing accidents are fatal because you're slow, you're close to the ground, you know, the wings are, you know, kind of parallel to the ground. You know, landing accidents almost never are fatal. So, yeah, this is an important issue.
Do you think, or was a contributing factor the prominence or stature of the passengers and the desire to, you know, get important people where they need to be?
I think that's a factor that can subtly or maybe not so subtly impress itself upon pilots. And it's mostly self-imposed. I was very active in the 90s with the Flying Doctors Group, Los Médicos Voluntarios. In fact, the website is one, is what, flyingdocs.org. That's a URL that I reserved back in 1995. I built the first website for them. And we fly volunteer doctors and dentists down to mostly Baja, Mexico, but also the state of Sonora. And it was always very clear to me that I had to be extremely careful as a pilot that I didn't make bad decisions simply because I had passengers on board who I felt, you know, needed to be back to work on Monday. And there were times where, you know, we would stop at the border in San Diego and those people would hop a you know, a Southwest flight, and I would sit there and wait until the weather got better. So I always try to have contingency plans so that I never felt that I was in a position where I, quote, you know, had to fly. You know, personally, I don't ever feel that I have to fly. I don't care how important the person on board is. I think I have a strong enough, you know, feeling about this that, you know, I could tell anybody, hey, we are not going to do this, period. I don't care who you are. And I think that's something that takes pilots time to develop, because it's easy, I think, to be intimidated, especially if you're a low-time pilot. And often it's self-imposed. I mean, if you were to have a frank conversation with a person on board and say, you know, I'm contemplating doing this and I just wanted to let you know it's, you know, potentially a little risky. You know what the answer is going to be? Hey, don't take any risk on my account.
Yeah.
No passenger is going to tell you, you better fly through that cloud, darn it, because I paid you to get me there.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds wise.
All right. Hey, we've heard from Dick Kapinski, who's the director of communications with the EAA. And I should have mentioned this one when we played Launchpad's recording earlier. He says that we are in full preparation mode for this year's fly-in, but circumstances surrounding the COVID-19 situation have caused some additional safeguards and procedures to be part of that planning. And that's what Launchpad was talking about. But what I'll add here is that there is an EAA page for Oshkosh 2021 COVID updates, which is simply eaa.org/COVID. And you can get the latest information there. So if you go to that webpage now, you'll see what their current thinking is for AirVenture. And it will be updated if situations change, but that's where you can see things like masks strongly recommended, proof of COVID vaccine will not be required to attend, and some other things, physical distancing, and so on and so forth. So that's where you can learn the latest information, eaa.org/COVID. On to some listener mail. Well, we received an email from Jay. He said, does anyone know whatever happened to DARPA and Boeing's disk rotor program? So this was a study, a project, where the idea is that instead of just rotors on the top of a helicopter, I guess, you have a disk that looks kind of like an AWACS disk. And you have blades sprouting from that. And I don't know, David, are you familiar with this program?
In so much that we have the program's wooden model at our museum.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, it was an experimental program for DARPA. And the rotor acted as the main lift device. As the aircraft got slower, the blades would extend out to provide more lift for hovering and takeoff. It's a compound helicopter. I think basically it didn't get beyond the design phase. I don't think there was even a mock-up built of it. So, I mean, it was an experimental program at Boeing down in Ridley Park, but it never, like a lot of things, never progressed beyond the design phase.
Yeah, that's Boeing Vertol. At least that was the name when I lived down in the Philadelphia area. And that's where they were doing all the design work on the V-22 Osprey for, gosh, 35 years, I would guess. Is that facility still there, David? And what are they doing now?
Yep, they build V-22s and C-47s, CH-47s still. And two-thirds of my docents are all from Boeing. They're all retired Boeing people. So it's still a valuable factory, and should Sikorsky win their contract for the next vertical lift flight helicopter, Boeing is part of that contract. So still building fuselages for V-22s, and I still kind of miss the days of smelling brownies when they were making carbon fiber rotors. They smell just like chocolate brownies.
Smell like brownies.
So I, but that's what happened when I was living only a quarter of a mile away from the factory.
Right. Well, we'll put some links in the show notes that talk about this DARPA disc rotor program. We even have an animation video. So even though this thing never went anywhere, or at least not very far, if you're interested in just kind of seeing what this looked like or what it was, you can check out the show notes. And we also got an email from Georgina. Georgina writes that, says, I have just put together this podcast on MH370, thought that your audience might be interested. And this is a podcast. It's called Monocle 24, The Curator. Monocle is an international news service, and this is the podcast of that service, Monocle. And this particular episode is titled The Impossible Case of MH370. And it's, let's see, I think this was about like a 50-minute recording, as I recall. And, you know, it's funny because I was just thinking about MH370 a few days ago, and then this this email comes in. So this episode kind of recounts all the events, what's known and so forth, you know, the search and all of that. So that's kind of the first part of this recording. The second part pretty much is speaking with a French journalist who has written a book that's titled The Disappearing Act, The Impossible Case of MH370. And obviously there are a lot of theories. Some of them really bizarre. Some of them involve aliens. Some of them are less radical. But there are a lot of different theories about what happened to MH370. And the author of this piece looks at what's known and some of the inconsistencies in sort of the official explanations. Also, she's captured some reports, some from Vietnam and other places that were, I don't know if suppressed is the right word, but maybe in some cases they were. But anyway, the basic theory is that it's a cover-up, that something completely different has occurred with MH370, that the area that was searched, that was all basically a smokescreen, that it probably involved some other some cargo that was on that aircraft. And you recall that aircraft was headed for China. There was one in the manifest, there was one shipment in cargo on that plane that arrived at the airport under heavy escort, and it was not X-rayed, and sort of completely outside of the normal process. So there's a lot of speculation there about that. So if you are interested in listening to this, it's a well-produced podcast. You know, from a technical standpoint, the content you can listen to if you like, and you know, decide if it's something that you want to, you know, stir into your personal pot of what happened to MH370 or not.
I think this is really the Amelia Earhart story of our time. Yeah, I suspect that, you know, the answer may not be found for just as long, you know, if ever, which means that, you know, people will come up with 100 different theories, and it's going to be really hard to prove one versus another.
I know. And you mentioned Amelia Earhart in Kathy's book, on the story of Gabby, the first Australian woman that you know did that flight that mostly followed Amelia Earhart's route, is that as she was doing that, she ran across this very old gentleman who told her that he actually physically saw the Japanese take Amelia Earhart away. You know, so there's always witnesses. There's always speculation. There's, you know. But you're right. I think MH370 is the modern-day Amelia Earhart story, at least so far. Dave wrote to us and said, I heard the mention of the Italian aircraft carrier coming to the Norfolk, Virginia area this month. No, he's got a Remember, I said, "Gee, is there a way to see the aircraft carrier?" He says, "One possible way it may be seen is by helicopter." Well, he has a friend that operates Hampton Roads helicopters out of Hampton Roads Executive Airport, which is KPVG, and they offer helicopter rides, charter instruction, sales, and so forth. And their website is hrheli.com. But he's offering that as, you know, that may be a way to take a look at the Italian aircraft carrier. But he did get, Dave did get his helicopter private commercial instrument CFI and CFII from them. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And if you get to see the Italian aircraft carrier, send us some pictures. All right. Well, with that, we'll wrap this up. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Kathy Mixted. She's an author, a writer, an editor, and sometimes a photographer. Some of her photo work I've seen is pretty good, actually. And she's also editor of Airsport magazine from the Sport Aircraft Association Australia. Of course, her new book is Australian Women Pilots, Amazing True Stories of Women in the Air. It's a great book, a lot of interesting stories, and they're kind of inspirational in ways. This would be a good book to give to younger folks, I think. Well, not just exclusively. I'm not saying it's a children's book. That came out wrong. I'm not saying that.
You're saying it's motivational.
It's motivational. And
inspirational.
Inspirational. That's a better word. So we thank Kathy for coming on the show. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. And you'll find show notes for this episode, all of our episodes there. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, of course, that's airplanegeeks.com/640. All right, Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, same place I've been for the last 5 days, which is the back half of the house.
So. Yeah.
If you're coming by, be careful. But folks can always find me at aviationnewstalk.com. You can click on contact and shoot me an email, or you can listen to the show any place you get your podcasts.
Excellent. And David Vanderhoof.
Well, you can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. But you can also find me on our Slack listener team, and you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you an invite. And last but not least, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy Max talking about drones on the UAV Digest.
Great. And you can find me on LinkedIn, on Twitter, at UAVDigest.com, at PaxXPodcast.com, and all of those things you can find at 30,000feet.com. All right. We'll ask that all of you please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.